My topic for today is called The Expectation of Change. And in it, I'd like to examine and address the collective change that the church is undergoing right now. We all recognize that the harvest period is a transition between two ages. It ushers out the gospel age, and it ushers in the millennial age. But within the harvest itself, there is a change. There is a transition from one condition or environment to another. In broad terms, the latter part of the gospel age harvest does not look like the fore part of the gospel age harvest. And the changes within the harvest are not event-driven. There is no prophetic event that introduces them. We only know that the change has taken place when we are in the midst of the change, and when we discern its characteristics. This then is where the challenge for each one of us enters in. And to many, this challenge can be an ordeal because the change is not a welcome one. In all respects, the latter part of the harvest is more difficult than the fore part. So we'd like to now look at two scriptural scenarios to illustrate the transition within the harvest. The first scriptural picture is found in Matthew 24:20, which says, "Pray that your flight be not in winter." Now, our understanding of this word picture is found in our overall scriptural scenario of the Battle of Armageddon. In Revelation, we are told that the final phase of Armageddon, during this time, religious systems such as the beast and the false prophet work in conjunction with the civil governments termed the dragon to exercise control over the Western nations. And this control is so absolute that they force everyone to receive the mark of the beast. Now, while we don't know with any specifics what this fully entails, it is telling us that everyone must make a show of allegiance to these religious and political structures. No dissent will be allowed. And during this winter time, which we believe is a short period of time, those who want to serve God in sincerity and truth will not be able to do so in any outward way. They will not be able to openly repudiate the teachings of those systems or their so-called allegiance to those systems. And sadly, they are the class who say in Jeremiah chapter 8 and verse 20, Jeremiah 8:20, "The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved." They have missed the opportunity to be part of the bride class because the door has been shut. And yet when we read Matthew 24:20 again, which says, "Pray that your flight be not in winter," there is an unmistakable implication that in some sense, some do have their flight take place during the winter-like unfavorable conditions. And we attribute this to the two ways in which Babylon is destroyed. There is first of all, a slow consuming process, and then a sudden destruction. This slow consuming process also brings about the winter-like conditions within Christianity. And one of these winter-like conditions that has developed within the systems is that there is an absence of the idea of a full and complete consecration of oneself to a life of sacrifice. Listening to Christian sermons today, as opposed to sermons in Brother Russell's day, vividly illustrates this change. And as the harvest progresses, it becomes increasingly difficult to even know what the true privilege of the call is at the present time, and perhaps even to see the need to come out of the systems. Now, brethren, we're not living in a vacuum, and these same forces which makes it harder for them also make it harder for us in our consecrated journey. Our culture is one of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die, and the live for the day concept. And the increasing hedonism of society has devalued the life of godly devotion. Another winter-like condition of the harvest that we have to deal with is the demographics of the Bible student movement. There are less of us. And this is not unexpected, as one by one, the brethren make their calling and election sure to their reward. But there are less crowns available, and therefore there are less spirit-begotten brethren. But brethren, consider the difficulties that this creates. Years ago, you'd have, 50 at your Sunday meeting, and hundreds of brethren at a convention. And you could spend your summer going from convention to convention, if you chose. Now, Sunday meetings consist of 5, 10, 15, and many brethren attend only one convention a year. And for those who were privileged to begin their consecrated life under more favorable conditions, think about how much strength you receive from all of that interaction. Think, too, of how, in the present time, the memories of those days continue to refresh you and to spur you on, even though you are now in the midst of fewer brethren. Consider now the brethren that don't have such memories. If you are young physically, or if you are young in the truth, you're lacking this benefit to your consecrated life. Those of us who have some memories of associating with a larger number of brethren really don't know what a detriment that is. And we try to make up for this lack of numbers by joining virtually online. But it cannot be denied that there is a loss in this type of interaction. Another winter-like condition that we have to deal with as the harvest progresses is the changing role of the messenger to this period of the church. We believe in Revelation 2 and 3, Jesus himself is shown as given a time-sensitive message of truth to 7 individuals. And these faithful ones dispense the truth that was so necessary for spiritual development during each phase of the church. And we believe that Pastor Russell was the 7th or last messenger to those living during the harvest. And just like the other messengers, Pastor Russell's ministry and writings took place at the beginning of the last stage. The sad reality is, as time goes on, and as society changes, and as culture changes, and as world events change, certain aspects of the messenger's message are less and less relevant. Obviously, we can no longer read the current events that Brother Russell referred to in the same way. When we look at the 4th volume, which deals with the Battle of Armageddon, we can truly see that Brother Russell's summaries and conclusions set forth scriptural principles that apply today. But the statistics and the supporting articles cannot be read with the same stimulating effect that it had on the brethren when those articles were current events. In my opinion, it is detrimental to have an ecclesia study on the 4th volume that treats this supporting evidence as relevant material to be studied in the same way as the conclusions. Instead, these should be viewed as archival reference material. Yes, of interest to some in private study, but not to all. And why do I say detrimental? When we insist that the brethren treat the American Cotton Tie Trust of 1895 and the 1873 demonetization of silver as relevant to our Christian life, it creates a distaste of the entire 4th volume. We lose the blessing of the spirit of this subject by insisting on a blind adherence to the letter. Now, what do we mean when we say that we should catch the spirit of a doctrine? It means that the doctrine has become vitalizing to us. It is life-giving food to our new creature because it puts us in touch with the mind of God, how he thinks, how he operates, and how he wants us to think and operate. And the most effective ecclesia study, even in the midst of the what's and the when's and the how's, should never lose sight of conveying the why. Emphasizing the spirit of the doctrines was very much the teaching of Brother Russell. The first and last chapter of every volume captures the essence of what he hoped we would take away. In times past, I would rush through those chapters to try to get to the meat of the subject. But brethren, this is the meat. Doctrines should inform our lifestyle. They should direct our behavior, our perspective, our thought patterns. So after I study the Gentile Times chapter, my conclusion should be, no matter the form of government, at heart they are all oppressive, and they are all marked for destruction. I cannot identify with any one of them. I can't identify with their leaders. I can't identify with their slogans. I see them for what they are. And I know that they will not carry over into the kingdom. What will carry over are the people, humanity. And that's who God identifies with. The poor, the needy, the brokenhearted, those yearning to be set free in order to live full and happy lives. And that's who I identify with. My neighbors, my co-workers, my family, and my friends. With such an emphasis, do not our ecclesia studies become vital and life-giving? Another factor that contributes to an increasing winter-like condition is the influence and role of the fallen angels. We know from Jude 6 that the angels which kept not their own estate or position were put into eternal chains of darkness until the judgment of the great day. And this judgment day in which their chains are loosened will determine their ultimate destiny. Our returned Lord presides as judge over the heavens and over the earth. And Brother Russell's understanding and our experience has shown us that their loosing and influence over mankind did not happen in full force immediately when the harvest began. Their ability to influence mankind increases during the period of the harvest, until their full fury is described as four winds that are let loose upon humanity. Think about the fact, brethren, that their full influence upon mankind is so horrific that Revelation 7 tells us that only the church is spared the final onslaught. And while the faithful are spared the worst, their malevolence will be directed against the Spirit begotten prior to that time. As we read in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1, 1 Timothy 4:1. Now the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will depart from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and the teachings of demons. We note the first part of this verse where the Apostle Paul was given a vision that explicitly warns the brethren of this test at the very end. And the method they will use is deception. This tells us that we will not be able to intellectually prepare for these tests. We cannot be forewarned as to their exact nature. Instead, we must glean from the scriptures the fallen angels' motivation, what they are trying to accomplish, and their characteristics in order to discern their hidden influence. At the beginning of the harvest, the world was just entering the age of technology. Photography, telephones and radios were still considered to be miraculous to most people. And to this technologically unsophisticated society, the fallen angels presented themselves in unsophisticated ways, with rapping and knocking on tables, mechanical writing, mesmerism, and hypnotism. But as technology increases and the sophistication of society increases, the influence of the fallen angels keeps pace. Likewise, our concept of spiritism and occultism must be modernized from Brother Russell's day. Let's consider for a moment what we're dealing with. The average human uses less than 10% of their brain and has an IQ of about 100. Spirit beings must be 300 IQ, 400 IQ, 500 IQ, with the full capacity of their mind, as they do not suffer degradation. Just to illustrate this point, we live in a three-dimensional world, and when we try to grasp the laws of the universe, we naturally conceptualize them in three dimensions. However, increasing numbers of people are beginning to have an understanding of the fourth dimension, which involves time and space. And it is by accessing this fourth dimension that something like materialization or time travel can take place. But the fourth dimension is only a theoretical construct to us. Yet spirit beings seem to move in and out of the fourth dimension as easily as we walk down the street. And when we think that physicists tell us that there are up to 11 dimensions, it is obvious that spirit beings are operating on orders of magnitude, both intellectually and physically, beyond what we can even comprehend. Why, though, do these superior beings have such a hatred for the inferior human race? As sons of God, as sons of the morning, they were originally the administrators of God's creation and sang for joy as it was being formed. But when God revealed his plan for the permission of evil and that he would ultimately replace them with a group of exalted humans, their jealousy was aroused. They wanted to retain dominion and control over mankind. So they conceived the plan of taking control over man's procreative ability in order to make people more susceptible to their rule. But God thwarted this attempt with the flood, and their freedom has been curtailed. And since then, their jealousy has been turned into a pathological hatred of humans. Now, once again, they are actively engaged in bringing the earth back under their power. When their schemes of planetary domination and control start to unravel, this hatred turns into a manic frenzy of destruction. If they can't rule the world, no one will. So, how are we supposed to contend against such powerful beings? And yet we are told in Ephesians 6:12 that in actuality, that is who we are wrestling with. We are given a glimpse of the different types of and ranks of fallen angels where it says, "For our struggle is not against enemies of blood and flesh, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." From the standpoint of the universe, we are taking part in a cosmic war. The place of the battle is planet Earth. You can either be on Jehovah's side, or you can be on the side of the rebellious spirits, who are in a battle to their death. And whether humans know it or not, their actions, their thoughts, and their attitudes are either supporting one side or the other. If God's ultimate desire for mankind is to have a race of beings that can worship him with all their hearts and all their souls and to love their neighbors as themselves, anything that would inhibit this type of love from developing is a weapon of the fallen angels and of the adversary. We, however, have chosen which side we're on. We fight for that which promotes the love of God and the love of fellow humans. But as humans, because we are so poorly equipped in this fight, all that our leader asks for is absolute loyalty. In this unequal fight, we are promised protection. Like Job, there is a hedge about us that the fallen angels are prohibited from breaching. But brethren, this protection only remains in place if we are truly his. Absolute loyalty can only be achieved if it's loyalty from the heart, not from the head. It is perfect love for Jehovah and not the fear of rebellious spirits that should direct our course of action. So we want to make sure that something like the vow is being used properly and that we have caught the spirit of it and not just the letter. There may be a tendency to use the vow as a talisman to ward off evil spirits when we focus on the phrase, "I will be on the alert to resist everything to akin to spiritism." But this viewpoint is limiting, as it narrows our focus to overt spiritism only, and it misses their more sophisticated influences at this end of the harvest. Instead, our focus should be on the phrase, remembering that there are but the two masters. In other words, whatever you are doing is either serving Jehovah's cause or Satan's cause. So brethren, more than ever, we must develop that perfect love for Jehovah, which is the only safeguard against the deception, the inhumanity, and the wickedness as winter descends. To summarize this section, when we reread Matthew 24:20 from our position at the latter part of the harvest, we sense the sadness with which Jesus said, "Pray that your flight be not in winter." We'd now like to look at the second scriptural scenario, which illustrates a transition or change in the harvest from a better condition to a less favorable condition. And this second scenario is found in Amos chapter 9 and verse 13. Amos 9:13. And it reads in part, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper." And this prophetic picture illustrates the fact that the time of trouble has an effect on the harvest work. In one sense, when we view the time of trouble in its final cataclysmic phase, which ends in civilizational collapse, the forces are sudden and destructive. And this is when the four winds are no longer held back, and they form a whirlwind which destroys the economic structure, the political structure, the religious structure, and the social structure of civilization. It is at the beginning of this whirlwind that the church class is complete, and thus the reaping phase of the harvest period is finished by force. But we can also view the time of trouble in its progressive sense, as a slow disintegration of civilization, beginning with our Lord's return. And from this perspective, the force used to disintegrate is truth on every subject. During our Lord's presence, there is a revealing of previously hidden things that cause changes in society, setting the stage for the final destruction. And these forces of truth also have an effect on the harvest work. They too are doing a plowing work of preparing the world for the millennial age sowing. Let us look at an example of one of these forces. As the superstition and false hold of religion is broken during the time of trouble, people are turned off by anything of a religious nature. The spiritual side of their life that was once held in place by custom and by fear and by peer pressure, it fades away, and it's replaced by apathy. And this secularization of society has an effect on the harvest work. Our labors in the harvest are met not with persecution, but with indifference. And this is how the time of trouble affects the harvest work now. While we are still laboring, the returns, both positive and negative, are diminished. When we view the current situation of the harvest work amongst the brethren in North America, this is exactly what we see. And I'd like to look at an example from my ecclesia, the Winnipeg Ecclesia. Beginning in the late 70s, our class wrote and produced a television program called Studies in the Scriptures on a community television station. And this TV show consisted of two or three brothers seated, having a back and forth discussion on a Bible topic. And this was a huge class project that lasted for 17 years. We had taping once a week, every Sunday morning before the meeting. And during the week, some of the brethren would be writing the scripts, some brethren would be typing the scripts, some brethren would be making photocopies of the scripts, some brethren would be taking pictures of slides and scriptures that would be used in the program. And then early on Sunday morning, a number of brethren would meet together at the TV station. Everyone had a job. Some were in front of the camera, some were manning the two cameras, some were on the slide machine, some were on the switching panel, and whoever was there would gather, and everybody was assigned a job. So, brethren, you can imagine the engagement we all felt as an ecclesia, both collectively and individually, doing the Lord's work. Incredibly, in 17 years of faithful work, no one even came to one meeting as a result of the TV program. While we received a few responses for literature in the beginning, for the last 10 years, I don't remember a single response, aside from a few crank calls on the class phone. But we know that people watched the show because all of us at our jobs had co-workers that would say to us, "I saw you on TV." But it neither garnered them in as wheat nor bound them as tares. Why? because they weren't religious people. And they only watched for a few minutes, and then they moved on. And the TV programs came to an end when the station manager approached us and said, "You know, in the 17 years that you've been on, the TV station has never received a single call or a single letter about your program. That's really not fair that you've been on here so long when there's other groups that would like to have access to this community station." And so we recognized the validity of that request, and this reaping work was stopped, not by the plowmen of persecution, but by the plowmen of people's indifference. Consider the main witnessing work done by ecclesias now. Most ecclesias have a website, but there's usually only one person in the class that has the skills to set that up and to maintain it. Interested parties might come on and download some material, but it's only a statistic. Questions might be asked, but they're anonymous and disconnected from location and from motivation. And just like everything else in society, our witnessing is becoming more automated and therefore more passive, and the human element is being removed. Now, what a contrast this is to the gathering of wheat by the co-porters of the Pastor's Day, or by the Frank and Ernest program of the post-war years. For many of us, the changing face of the harvest constitutes a trial. It is an unwelcome change that flies in the face of our expectations. We would all like to be engaged in an ecclesia-wide project that is generating hot responses and cold responses until we're forcibly taken off the scene. But that isn't what is happening in North America. And as we have all experienced, sending money overseas does not replace the personal need we feel to be actively engaged in the harvest work. And so we feel discouragement because we feel like there's really no work for us to enter into. Well, the only way to combat this discouragement is the realization that the root cause is the changing circumstances of the harvest. That the earlier part of the harvest was easier, and the latter part of the harvest becomes increasingly difficult. And these changing conditions necessitate a change in us. But we have to be careful, very careful, brethren, that it is a change of perspective and not a change of message. We still have only two authorized messages. The first is, "Go ye and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit." And the other is, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye be not receivers of her plagues." And looking back upon the Bible student movement since Brother Russell's death, the lesson is clear, that we are not to supersede these commandments by proclaiming another call to an earthly class, or by proclaiming the end of the harvest and the closing of the door. What then should be our perspective as of the harvest at the present time? Well, we notice that there are three scriptural word pictures of witnessing. Two are time-related, and one is time-independent. In the first, witnessing is likened to fishing, where during the gospel age, nets were cast into the water. And when the net was full, it was drawn ashore, and the harvest work began of dividing the fish between the desirable and the undesirable. The second scriptural picture of the harvest work is that of a farmer, who during the gospel age broadcasts his seed into the field, hoping that it would hit good ground. The wheat grows until its maturity, and then the wheat is harvested. A division is made between the tares and the wheat. In both pictures, during the gospel age, the focus is on casting forth the truth. And during the harvest, the focus is on doing a dividing work. But in our last scriptural picture of witnessing, there is only one work. And it matters not if it is during the gospel age or during the harvest. I'd like to read Matthew 5. Verses 14 to 16. Matthew 5, 14 to 16. "You are the light of the world. A city built upon a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under the bushel basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." To me, there are three characteristics that define this type of work. First of all, no one is described as going out and doing something. Instead, you are in place and doing something. Secondly, the light is noticeable, not because it is as bright as a bolt of lightning, but it is noticeable because of the contrast to the darkness everywhere else. And thirdly, the light on the lampstand has a beneficial effect to those who see it. So let's analyze how to put this word picture of witnessing into effect at the present time. First, who are we witnessing to? At every stage of life, there are people that we come in contact with on a regular basis. These are people that we have common interests with, aside from spiritual matters. These are people that we socialize with outside of the brotherhood. They can be people that we encounter while at work. Perhaps we live in a close-knit neighborhood. Or maybe we're fortunate enough to have a large and extended family that is close-knit. Or perhaps you are undergoing health problems, and you are dealing with doctors and nurses and receptionists and home care workers. Or you could even be a member of an online community. And whether you're anonymous or not, you are interacting, and therefore you have an influence upon a particular group of people. I suggest that we take some time to consider who at the present time is in our sphere of influence, because it is upon these people that your light is shining. Now we must ask, how specifically do we witness in this manner? Unlike other pictures of witnessing, this is not a message-driven or message-first witness. Instead, our actions and our lifestyle pave the way for a message to be received. As indifference to spirituality increases in society, people require trust to be built first before they will listen. And we build this trust by living differently than others. And the contrast of our lifestyle to everyone else's lifestyle is the light that is set on the hill, or that we set this lampstand to be seen. And our consecration ideals or what must inform and direct our lifestyle. So this means what? That we are to engage in ethical employment, ethical investing, ethical purchasing, ethical entertainment, and ethical social interaction, including social media. And within our sphere of influence, our actions should be directed by Christian and kingdom principles. One being, love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, we don't support people or businesses that harm other people. Will this create challenges and complications in our life? Absolutely. But it is those very things that set us apart and are in contrast to those who are not children of light. The other Christian and kingdom principle that informs our lifestyle is love the Lord your God with all your heart. In other words, we do not participate in social activities, and we cannot enjoy entertainment that does not support Jehovah's side in this cosmic battle. Will this create misunderstandings and challenges in our life? Absolutely. But it is those very things that set us apart and are in contrast to those who are not the children of light. So, in conclusion, brethren, despite the fact that we find ourselves in the late stages of the harvest, with its attendant difficulties, the Lord has not left us without instruction for our present predicament. When we internalize the spirit of His words, we find the method by which we can adapt to the changes that are here and to those that lie before us. And it is by His strength and His power that we will be able to persevere and to make our calling and election sure. Lord, I bless you.